the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is WebSphere Data Power SOA Appliances and XSLT Part 2 of 2 Tips and Tricks. Today's presenter is Herman Stambubrand. Herman joined the IBM WebSphere Data Power team in April 2007. The first year, he was part of the worldwide Level 3 support team. Later, he worked as developer in the XML compiler team of Data Power. Within this team, he is responsible for the fixed pack work related to the XML compiler since then. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Herman.
Hello. This day's talk is second talk after the first talk on Tuesday on XSLT tools, built-in and external tools for data power SOA appliances. Like the last webcast, this webcast will present information which originated by real customer problems and PMRs from the last years and the solutions found and workarounds found for them. Next slide, please. So the agenda is not that big today. The first section will be tips and tricks. That's the main section. It contains a lot of information. The second section will be on graphics. What this means will be shown later. You know, Data Power does not have any graphics card or so, although it's interesting to see what Data Power can do in producing graphics by XSLT. Next slide, please. First, I want to talk about the Data Power data representation available. And while it's well known that we have an XS string type and an XS nodeset type, XS nodeset for a set of nodes in XML, it's interesting that normal XML is just represented not as a string but as an XS blob. The reason for that is that we also see a possibility to have binary data within Data Power. I first created this diagram based on information found in the extension functions catalog referenced below to give an overview of the different conversion functions available. Some are well known, some are not so well known. So the very first is if you want to have any binary or non-binary input, you can use the DP binary encode function in the middle below to get a Base64 encoded string. And what's not so well known is that you can convert this Base64 string to a hex binary encoded string by calling a number function called RadixConvert, which just replaces the radix of the number. It's interesting that this works because Base64 encoding is not really a number because numbers don't have padding characters. But in Data Power, this works quite well. As you can see, you can go the opposite direction by calling radix convert by conversion from radix 16 to 64. That's very important because while Base64 is a string and can be handled in Data Power, it's quite cumbersome to really access any part of it. By converting it to a hexadecimal string, it's very easy to select parts of it and to work on them. So now we are at the Base64 string, and we have going up to the upper right, we can go there with a DP parse. We can have, if the Base64 encoded string is an encoding of an XML document, the DP parse function parses this XML document. If you go give it the Base64 argument, and the result is a node set, XML node set. The same node set can be created if you go just from the XML representation as string with the DP parse function without an extra argument. The opposite direction from the node set to an XS blob is done by the DP serialize, which transforms a node set to a string, which can be sent somewhere and processed there by, for example, a DPPals and then working on the XML. Very important is the general guideline, prefer use of extension functions over pure XSLT solutions of your own because of performance, because extension functions in data power are implemented in a very efficient way, much more efficient than pure XSLT normally. Next slide, please. Here, this slide is on a technique called Münchian grouping. It's a very important technique invented in 2000. The inventor is a person called Steve Münch, and he invented this technique by writing a book on XSLT. The very important aspect of this Münchian grouping is that it's the only method we can use on data power where we only have an XSLT 1.0 processor to simulate for each group statement which is available in XSLT 2.0. What this means is that you have a set of nodes and they are grouped by some criteria and you only want to access one element for each group. And how this works can be seen in the lower left part of the style sheet. The very important first thing is you have to define an XSL key. In our example here, key with name B. And the key is a mapping from the OS attribute. And the mapping value is the identity. The dot is referencing just this attribute. So Linux will be mapped on Linux, Mac on Mac. On the right side, you see a sample of browsers, versions, operating system versions, and browser versions. And the style sheet, which this is a part of, produces from this input the table in the bottom right. And very important for creating this HTML table is that we want to have a column for Linux, Mac, mobile, or Windows, but we only want to have one entry for each operating system, regardless how often it is called. So this key B, which maps the operating system to itself, is then used. If you now look in the first line of the next section, on the very right side, you see the key B is applied to the current node, and that means you will get an array of all nodes with the same operating system. And then you access just the first element by the parenthesis 1. And then you do a generate ID. Generate ID is a very important function. It generates a unique ID for any node in an XML document. You cannot be sure that you get the same ID for the next time processing of the XML document, but during one processing of an XML document, this ID is unique. And the trick here is, how do I detect that I'm the first one? I just generate the ID of the first node in the set of all nodes with the same operating system value, and then I compare it to the generate ID of the current node. And this is only true for the very first node in the set of all nodes with the same operating system. And so you see the for each loop iterates over all operating system attributes, but only the first one will enter the inner part of the for each loop. And then you, for example, can even do an XSL sort, which leads to the nice alphabetical sorting of Linux, Mac, mobile, Windows you see in the table. Again, for all slides in this presentation, either it's a reference to the appendix or there are links to articles, forum postings or tech notes, so you can find all the information needed for doing the same experiments yourself. Next slide, please.
And just for your information, we are currently moving on to slide number 5.
This slide is on doing recursion right. As you all know, there are different kinds you can do recursion. The easiest way of doing recursion is tail recursion. You are doing processing of the first element, and after that you just do a recursive call for the rest. That's a very bad pattern for data power, at least if the number of elements is big, because the problem is that you can run out of stack space easily. Even if you are able to increase the stack size under the compile options policy of an XML manager, the memory for stack is limited, and so you will definitely run into problems. A better solution for this is doing divide and conquer technique. You split the problem into several parts. The easiest way is just to split it into two halves. Then you do recursive calls on both parts, and then you combine the results. On the right side, you see a sample, which is also available as a posting on XSL list reference below. It's just determining the largest common prefix of two strings. I don't want to go into the real details of this, but as you see in the very first lines, we have two strings, A and B, and the external call template, common prefix, just already made sure that both strings are having the same length. And so we can just calculate the middle in the MID variable by the string length of the string A and divide it by 2 and just round it down. And then we generate the first half of both strings, A1 and B1. And then we are splitting the problem. If the first character of both strings don't agree, then we just return the empty string. If the first half, A1 equals B1, then we just output this with an XSL value of that and call for the right part. Otherwise, there's a difference in the first half, and we are doing the recursive call on the left part. So now, switch to slide number 6, please. Yeah, this is an interesting and important issue. We had a big customer who made use of Google Web Services, and the Google Web Service was broken. What does it mean? If a web service is broken, very easy. An XML document may return an XML declaration, but must not. But if it does not contain an XML declaration, the encoding is a default encoding, which is UTF-8. But if the document returned is not UTF-8 encoded and the XML declaration is missing, this is broken. At that point in time, Google Web Service was broken, and we could say, okay, it's not a problem of Datacore, it's a problem of Google, but we wanted to provide a solution to the customer. And the solution is that we found that by analyzing the data returned, that the intended encoding was, in fact, ISO 8859/1, which consists of, for example, the German umlaut and the Danish and Swedish and other characters. There are only 256 of them, but it's a big set. And so the solution was just pretending the encoding we know from the data before working on it. The problem is if DataPower receives the document, it's a non-XML document. And so the trick is the following. The first step is you convert the non-XML input data into hexadecimal XML representation. We are making use of a little FFD, hex binary FFD, to do so. Then we have a hexadecimal string. Then we prepend the XML declaration, version 1.0, encoding ISO 88591, whatever it is. We cannot do this in clear text, because we are now in hexadecimal encoded, so we are prepending the hexadecimal encoding of this, and then convert the whole XML hexadecimal stuff back to binary. The whole thing you can see on the top right part, the template which matches conversion hex string, you see just very long hexadecimal string, which is just the hexadecimal representation of the XML declaration, and then just an identity copy of the string. This solution may be best used in a proxy. You have a proxy where the request rule is just pass-through to the Google web service or whatever web service. And the response side, you are doing this workaround on the response rule. So any service in Data Power or elsewhere accessing the web service through this proxy will always see correct XML, and that's what's needed. Next slide, please. Slide number 7. There was another customer who had a big legacy data, 8-bit data, and the requirement was that he just wanted to get rid of the escape characters, the controller characters in the range from 0 to 31. He also wanted to have the characters with a character value of under 28 and bigger converted, escaped. And finally, he wanted to create a wrapper element around it so he can process this legacy 8-bit data within a style sheet. And the solution I found for this was just another divide and conquer recursive solution. So first, the non-XML data will be converted to a hexadecimal representation with the same hex binary SSD. Then recursive calls will be done until down to a byte level. Byte level means until the string length of the hexadecimal string is of length 2. Then we are just looking whether the first character, the first digit, hex digit is a 0 or a 1. In this case, we just replace the character by 20, which is the encoding of the space. Otherwise, we just do the identity. It's the very first line on the top right part of the style sheet. Afterwards, we prepend a wrapper tag, append a slash wrapper, a closing wrapper tag, and we prepend the ISO 88591 encoding. Why do we do that? We do that because this automatically does the transformation to the escaped representations for characters of code 128 or bigger. That's very important because it's very efficient to do this with the encoding. If you do this in a style sheet, it's much, much slower. And finally, the converted hexadecimal string is converted back to its binary representation, which is exactly what the customer wanted. In this case, I tried another solution. You know, we have XSLT extension functions. We have all functions available in the regular expression packet. And I tried a solution with a regular expression replace. You see, the from is the regular expression we want to transform, and the to is what to transform to. So the from is from the beginning, the carré, then any byte. The byte is a sequence of 2 hexadecimal digits. The star is meaning 0 or more. And for the first character, we only allow characters from 2 to 9 and A to F, which means non-control characters, non-control characters. And finally, a control character, which begins with a 0 or a 1. And this will be replaced by the matched string, but only the first part without the control character and then followed by a 20. In regular expression, you would have written backslash 1. In Data Power, all variables are referenced by dollar, and even the regular expression is referenced by $1 for the first, $2 for the second. Interesting here was that the regular expression replay solution is less performant than the recursive style sheet, and that's a good sign for the high quality of the compiled result of our compiler. You may find the both solutions with and without the regular expression in the appendix, so you can try it out. Slide number 8, please. Yeah, that's a really cool thing. I will show you the reason why I needed this later in the presentation. The task is the following. If you have a SOAP with attachment, and the attachment on the right side you see it is CID backup zip, it's a backup zip, Data Power backup, which is already available as a SOAP with attachment. And as you may know, if you open a Data Power backup, you will see for each application domain a zip file with the same name. So here in this example, the backup contained 4 domains, domain 1 to domain 4, and the task was, at the end of this transformation, the all application domain zips should be extracted from the backup zip and appended as new zip attachments. And we have solved this attachment, so we need a SOAP envelope and a body. And if you look on the left side, the first thing is we have to get the information out of the backup zip. Very important file is here is the export.xml file. If you see on the picture in the top right, the first action is a fetch action. It has input, and it uses the URL CID backup zip, then question mark, so in the start of the query part, there's an important feature called archive equals zip. That means we tell data power this is a zip file, and with file name equals export.xml, we say we just want to extract the export.xml file from here. And this is the input for the style sheet we see here. This style sheet should be executed, should process all domains, so it should iterate. But the iteration itself will be done by the for each action you see on the as the next action in the transformation, and the xparse expression of the for each action is /data power configuration /domain/domain. So this automatically iterates over all domains in the export.xml. And for each, the transform action on the very top is executed, and the arrow shows that this transform action is the style sheet depicted in the lower left part. So you see, after template matching the root element, the first is an envelope and a body, and then because this loop action always outputs to a context named out, we have to get a copy of the previous result to just get one and the next and the next. This is done by the first copy of statement, and we access the context, the previous result, by DP variable var context out, and from there we don't want to copy the whole document but only what is inside the envelope body. So we, for each iteration, we get the old stuff and the new element done, which leads to the XML output shown in the lower right. The next thing is we extract the zip file name. The very important thing is here to know the for each action set a service variable called multi-step loop iterator. So the zip file name is just accessing this DP variable, accessing its name attribute, and concatenating it with .zip. So it's iterating over the domains. We just append zip, and so we have the zip file name. The next is we output the zip file name to achieve the result in the lower right border. And then the next two parts are all what's needed. First, we open a temp variable with a DP URL open, and we just say we want to extract from CID backup zip, the archive format is zip, and the file name is, and we just concatenate it with the zip file name. And we say we have a binary node as a response. This is like extracting the zip file. The next step is we want to attach this extracted zip file. This is done again with the DP URL open, this time not an empty URL open, but with a content. And the content is the copy of $temp result binary child node. This is accessing exactly the extracted binary part and not anything else. And the target is attachment out CID zip file name, so we just attach it with its own name. So you see CID domain 1 zip, 2 zip, and zip all. Very important here is to use the result mode SWA, because if you don't specify this, the attachment will be done but are not available in the same policy. If you use result mode SWA, the attachment CID domain 1 zip, 2, and all the others which are generated here will be available even for the next action in the transform. All information about the attachment protocol you can find in the XSL Accelerator Developer's Guide. reference below. Slide number 9, please. So now we are coming to a bigger section of little workaround. While there is no statement in XSLT 1.0 to set the current node, we can just use statement which is there by doing so. The statement to use here is the XSL for each statement. And if you select one element node set, then you are setting implicitly the current node. We had a customer who wanted to make use dynamic evaluation call as part of an XPath expression. You see expression 1 slash dot 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 slash expression n slash dyn evaluate. This is not allowed by the XPath 1.0 specification because the different paths between the slashes are so-called XPath steps, and they are just for addressing. You cannot use any functions in there. But the solution was easy for the customer. You can use, in the second line you see it, XSL for each, select, and then the complete XPath expression. This sets the current node, and then execute dynamic evaluate in the next statement, and all is fine. Another thing is, there is a statement called XSL apply import. You may know or not. It's different from XSL include in the following way. If you do an XSL include, it's exactly the same as if you would pass in the included document at exactly that point in the including style sheet. If you do an XSL import, the difference is that the priorities of all templates are reduced a little bit. So whenever two templates are having the same name, the one from the outer style sheet would be used because of a higher priority. But you can explicitly call to match only style sheets from the imported one by the XSL apply import statement. So the select would be nice, but it's only available in XSLT 2.0. If you really need that, there is a solution, a workaround solution for 1.0, which is referenced below, the XSL apply import select technique. It's not straightforward, but it works. Another simple workaround, if you have a string and you just want to iterate over the lines, so it's just good to know we have the string package from the extension functions, and str:tokenize does the tokenization of the string. And if you say you want to tokenize by ampersand hash 10 semicolon, which is the encoding of the line feed character, then you will get an array of strings, one for each line, and if you do an XSL for each over that, you iterate over it, and you can do whatever you like. Next thing is interesting. It was part of a real PMR. If you have XML content in a variable called $sum.xml, and you want to insert this variable as inside part of another XML document, it's very important to know that you inherit all the namespaces from the outer document. If this is not wanted, then you don't insert $sum.xml, but the serialization of it. And you get it back with a DP pass. Very important part of fix, which just was available with April fix pack on that show unformatted in Multistep Pro to display namespaces which were not in the customer document. Slide number 10, please. In a previous talk I gave about this subject, customer asked on a problem that non-XML requests at a multi-protocol gateway for requests or response didn't set the request size and response size service variable. They are always zero. And during the talk, I found the solution, and the solution is simple. You already know it. We use the hex binary FFD for converting non-XML data to a hexadecimal string. And the hexadecimal string's length is exactly double the input length. So just dividing it by 2, you get the length. The customer made use of it in error processing. So he is not interested in the variables normally, but if there is an error condition and the error rule, he wanted to give back error in processing a document of length, and then you wanted to have the binary length of the input document. And the other event I also talked about the time versus space performance improvement for SQL injection filter, which is available with a December fix pack. You should definitely have looked into the file store SQL injection filter and look for the comment which contains the word pseudo. It's a very interesting technique. It's a double-digit factor of performance increase by just giving a little bit more memory and achieving a really, really huge increase in runtime. Slide number 11, please. XSLT libraries. I want to talk first about a specific library I started building 1.5 years ago. It has many basic operations, especially all the operations needed to convert from BASE64 to hexadecimal to normal and do different kinds of operations like concatenation and substring operations for all these types. And especially bit operations were implemented. And you may say, okay, bit operations in XSLT? Yeah, you can do so. And the reason is crypto typically operates on bit values. And on the right side, you see a sample function of this text library. It's the operation of shifting right a hexadecimal value and inserting a zero bit from the left. So you see, the choose is just a test whether which of the 16 hexadecimal characters is in place, and it just replaces, just returns as a result the right shift right value, which is basically a divide by two and truncation. Having all this information, these functions available, shift right with zero, with one, shift right not only for a single digit but for a whole string, you can use and or and all that stuff. You can do really interesting stuff. The one application I used it for was, if you have from Microsoft NTLM protocol, I got a 56-bit key hexadecimal, and I needed to use this key in a DES operation. But the DES operation on data power is implemented as 64-bit operation, and each byte is assumed to have a parity bit. And so the style sheet which did the job was just using this library and filling in the parity bits in order to apply this transformed key to by the DES function on data power. Another colleague jumped in from GBS and from services and created an ASIN1 library on top of that. That's a really cool stuff because it's ASIN1 is a format for describing binary data and being able to parse that. And this allowed him, for his customer, to do a validation of a certificate just from the mathematical side. Because the customer created certificates which start in the future, he wanted to just know if that point in time is arrived, whether the certificate would be fine on the box. And data power validation only allows to check for the current point in time, not for the future point in time. And so this implementation was able to do this validation. The library has a lot of documentation. Status is it's an IBM internal library currently, but it's already used in service engagements by IBM service people. Very important statement is create your own libraries. They are really good for code reuse. Slide number 12, please. On Tuesday's call, we talked about the different data processing modes of data power, the DOM processing mode, the SACS processing mode, and the streaming processing mode. And here's a use case which seems not being able to be done on a data power box, but it is. A German tech sales had a problem that at a customer, a customer did XSL pool processing. Customer had a 130 megabyte XML file, and the transformation was done without data power, and it took hours. And he modified that and made it processing on data power, and the complete processing took place in 20 seconds. And the output was exactly the same. So customer was really happy about that and now has a slightly bigger XML file, especially the sub-problem which is now to be solved before the XSL full processing. The XML file needs to be sorted. And the problem is this XML file is of size 10 gigabytes. So we cannot use the processes DOM-like because 10 gigabytes is much bigger than the memory available inside data power. But we cannot also stream this because the XSL sort operation is not streamable. You know, if the last element of the sorting will be the first, you have to remember it until the very first last point in time. But slide number 13, please. Yes, we can. We can do it by a combination of all the techniques we have seen on Tuesday and today. The technique to use here is data swiping by partial streaming. This is something which is not possible by other XSLT compilers because they don't support the partial streaming technique, where you may find the details on Tuesday's webcast. The first step is we are doing partial screening and just select the indices which are used for sorting. And this should result in a small file because the indices are IDs or names or whatever, but they are normally a very low part of the record, a very low size part of the record. So the result file of containing all these indices should be small compared to the 10 gigabyte. Then we send this file to a service doing München grouping for us, and this will determine the unique indices which are available in the input file. Then we iterate over all the unique indices, and we select the index stripes by partial streaming. So we just send in the complete file and say, please select only this special index, all entries with this index. And we store each index stripe into a separate file. And finally, we join all these files which have been created in sort order, and that's it. The good thing is that this you need to store the complete file once, and the sum of all the partial files is exactly the size of the original file, so you need just storage of 2 times the input file which you want to process. Currently, the solution is done by a shell script for orchestration of all the different activities. The plan is to have this completely inside data power. The question is, where do we store these files? They are big files. We need to have 20 gigabytes of space for the sample, and the solution is there is no API for the internal hard disk. There are hacks, but it's not so good. But you can use just an HTTP server. HTTP POST is used for storing, and HTTP GET for reading. And so you have a solution for this. Slide number 14, please. Yeah, some useful books and references. The very first thing is the Essential XML Quick Reference by Skonnard and Gudgin. It's an old book. I have been using this book for 3 years now, and it's a really cool book presenting all the XML, XPath, XSLT, and all this stuff. It was recommended to me from a colleague, and now it's available as free download. Just click on the link, download it, and you have more than 400 pages. Good book. The next link is Data Power SOA Appliances Library, where you can find the product documentation. Then we have Data Power SOA Appliances Forum, where you can find information, ask questions, help others. There is a non-data power email list called XSL List. I think it started in the mid of the 1990s, and since then all the stuff is archived. So it's a very big archive of XSLT questions and solutions. And I would say 2/3 of the stuff discussed on that list is for XSLT 2.0. But at least 1/3 should be on XSLT 1.0, and so this is still interesting for data power use. Another email list is the XSLT mailing list. There is not much activity right now, but if you have a question on XSLT, you will get answers there. Slide number 15, please. Yeah, now we come to the graphics section. Slide number 16, please. And what I want to propose is the use of a really cool graph visualization library. The problem is not drawing, but layout. And Graphis, it's a package available under httpgraphis.org. It's a set of layout algorithms. The very important thing is under the Common Public License version 1.0, which is good. It allows us at IBM to use it, and it even allows us at IBM to make customers aware of it and propose solutions using it. There are several layout programs, Dot, Neato, and all the others you can find on that site. What I used here is the Dot layout program. It's a hierarchical layout program for directed graphs, and it has a huge amount of output formats. You can output to GIF, JPEG, PNG, SVG, PS, and PDF. In the middle, you see a textual description of a graph. A digraph B is a directed graph. You see some two subgraph definitions, and then you see, for example, start minus greater A0 semicolon. That means that you want to have an arrow from the start node to the A1 node. If you look on the picture on the right side, you see on the top the start node, on process 1 cluster, the first node is A0, and you see the arrow. And you can specify the shapes, you can specify the colors, you can specify filled or non-filled. Really cool stuff you have there. There's a good documentation document, 30 or 40 pages on the DOT program and all its features. It's really cool. On slide number 17, please, we will see a first use within data power environment. We talked about data power backups before. In the data power backups, there is a subdirectory called dp-aux, which contains all auxiliary data which is needed for data power to be able to import the backups on probably different firmware releases. And very important file of this directory is called drmanagement.xml. It's a 2 megabyte XML file describing all configuration and status settings which were there at the point this backup was created. And the configuration objects have a hierarchy, and on the right side you see a nice picture just showing this hierarchy. Because the picture is a little bit bad to read, I highlighted the middle part and put it in the lower part as a zoom. And you see, first line is we have an HTTP proxy service, and inherited from that, we have two different services you may know, the XML firewall service and the XSL proxy service. And then we have other services. And the interesting thing is that all which is needed to produce this picture is this template, which is shown above. That's all. You are matching for objects, so you're matching / management information / config objects, and then any successor node of type object and whose parent name is not config object. So we are accessing all the objects on the right side. The left side is config base at the root node. And then we are determining the parent and the node itself. There are some utility functions for just getting the node transformed into what the dot format wants. And so you see node is dot label from dot class from the current node, and the parent is from actually the grandparent, because the node in between is inherited object node, which is not important. And then finally we just draw the arrow. So we do an XSL value of select equals $parent. Then we do the minus greater for the R, for the arrow. And then we say the arrow goes to node. And because the picture will get nice without that, we specify additionally that the tail port is east, so the arrows start on the east side of a node, and the head port is west, so they end on the west to get this picture, because otherwise you will get funny pictures, but they are not so good for reading. You can find the complete style sheet in the appendix. Slide number 18, please. So this now is a sneak preview. This is the only stuff which the complete information is not part of the presentation or available elsewhere. The reason is this will be published as a developer work article. I got allowance to do the publish. It will be a bigger article describing how to do this and how to customize it. And essentially, it makes you able to just upload any backup of your data port. You see on the top right of the slide, HTTP form. The first is a backup zip to draw. You just browse a backup on your local computer. Then you have a .to-PDF service. If you don't have one entered in this second input field, then clicking on submit form will get your backup zip and generate a .dot file from that. You can just take the .dot file data, store it somewhere, and convert them by hand with the dot tools on Graphisorg to GIF or PDF or whatever. But if you give a service in this second input field, the transformation will be done automatically, and the result, the PDF in this example, will be directly displayed in the browser. So you get a picture, a bird's eye view on your configuration automatically. And how is this done? On the lower part of this slide, you see that if I apply the backup zip drawing to itself, so the picture here is the application itself, which is responsible for drawing the backup. Very first thing is you see the HTTP form on the top right. It's hosted on data power by the HTTP service on the lower middle, HTTP service with name SWA form on port 32,080. If you click on submit, it will be submitted to port 32,084, and you see in the middle that there is an XML firewall called SWA form, which has output port 32,083, and I output the remote address is 127.001, which is localhost. Then you have to find any service which is having 32,083 on the right as input, and this is exactly the one you see on the right side, the HTTP front side handler for a multi-protocol gateway, and the multi-protocol gateway draw domains is doing a combined thing. The first thing is extracting all the domain backup zips like we have seen on page 8 before, and finally it's applying the drawing to what gets extracted by that. And how this drawing is done, I want to describe by just an XML firewall service. This template is the complete template which produces this nice picture, especially for the XML firewalls, which are shown in the middle of the drawing. So you see, the first thing is you define a variable node, and you just get unique identifier for that node, and then you draw that node by just putting it out to dot and with a value f, and then you say the shape is an octagon for getting the graphical output different from other objects. You give the label, and so you see the XML firewall / n and the name attribute is exactly what produces the output you see below. Then you produce the node, the arrow pointing into the firewall. So you have an arc, an arrow from local address minus greater to the node itself. And the attribute is the label, which is the port number, which is put onto that arrow, which is local port in this case. And then we have three possibilities. The backend of the firewall can be static backend, loopback proxy, or it can be dynamic. The static backend case is simple. We just output the arrow from node to the remote address, and the label on the arrow is just the remote port. That's exactly what you see below in the diagram for the XML firewall's SWA form and make SWA. If you have a loopback proxy, we just get an arrow from the node to itself. We have no example here. And the interesting stuff is if you have dynamic backend, we don't know where to draw. So we want to draw to nowhere. But nowhere is not a node. So we need a node, and you see how to do it. The first line of the otherwise statement, we have label is the empty string and shape is none. So we have a node which is invisible, and it needs a unique ID. And we just make use again of the generate ID function, because for this node, the generate ID is unique, and we just use its ID as the name of the empty node. If we don't do this, then every dynamic service would point to the same empty point, and this is not what's looking good. And below we are doing the arrow. So this is a really nice tool. It makes use of the SWAform tool mentioned on Tuesday's call webcast. It makes use of the unzipped domains on page 8 of this presentation. And finally, it makes use of generating graphical output with GraphS library shown in the previous and this slide. On the right side, you see a complete drawing of customer configuration, because I'm not allowed to show details on a customer configuration. I minimized it so much that you cannot see any detail of it, but you can see at least one detail. The customer has configured four Ethernet ports, because Ethernet ports are drawn as blue boxes. And so on the left side of that picture, you see that the four interfaces. So slide number 19, please. Yeah, now the appendix, slide number 20. This is not for reading. It's just for copying and pasting and trying out the examples. Slide number 21, please. The second part of the appendix, and slide number 22, please. Yes, we talked this day about data representations, about Minkin grouping and divide and conquer recursion as general techniques. We talked about customer issues of repairing broken web service and dealing with legacy 8-bit data, and on how to deal with software attachments, creating new attachments, extracting from attachments, using for each action. We spoke about several workarounds, libraries, and useful books and references, and finally we talked about graphics. Slide number 23, please. This chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. Visit the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site to learn more about upcoming WebSphere Support Technical Exchange webcasts, like the one you attended today, and access previously recorded presentations. DeveloperWorks offers in-depth technical information. Visit WebSphere.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up to the learning curve quickly. The SR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Notifications link on all product support pages lets you sign up for free weekly email updates for products of interest to you. And now I want to hand over to Joseph.
Thank you, Herman, for a great presentation. At this point in time, Diane, we would like to open the line for questions.
Chuck Chang, you may ask your question.
Well, thanks for the presentation. I joined the first one and the second one. They are fabulous. I have a couple questions. I'm a data power developer. Sometimes it kind of bothers me that data power is, well, let me put it this way. If I want to take advantage of some examples, I can copy and paste, but if I have to customize it, chances are I will use my editor on my laptop and modify the style sheet and upload it into data power manually. Is that how you do it in the lab where the development environment and the runtime are separated? I wonder if you have a simulator or something. I know there was like a Eclipse plugin I could use, but I don't think the function is available after version 3.8. So I just wonder how do you do it in the lab?
If I'm editing the style sheets externally, I use a very old editor called VI. If I edit them on the box, I use just the file management. And I learned some weeks ago by a discussion on the external data power forum that if you modify a style sheet on the data power box, directly referenced by a service, then you don't have to do anything. The style sheet will automatically be recompiled. Only if the style sheet is, for example, only included by a style sheet which is directly referenced, you need to flush the style sheet cache. In the previous webcast, I presented the bookmarking technique, and the most important bookmark I have in use is the style sheet cache bookmark, which opens a page where I'm able to flush the style sheet caches for different XML managers. But normally, just editing a style sheet and sending traffic against the server using it just works, so you don't have to use any external data.
Okay. Yeah, the reason about the external editor is that you will highlight like the tags, make sure all the elements were matching, you know, the starting tag and ending tag.
Yeah.
So, well, I think I got to choose either way. So you guys don't have like an emulator or something locally, so you can test it on your...
Okay, developers have something, but it's not available to anywhere, even not to support people in IBM.
Okay.
But if you have an XSLT and you want to have it look nice, I just use tidy-xml to get a nice layout of a style sheet or XML file.
Gotcha. Okay. That's my first question. Second question is, you kind of mentioned that in the presentation, you mentioned that we got to stick with Excel T.1.0 as well as XPath. is there any technical reason that Data Power did that old version?
Very simple reason. If you look at the specification of XSLT 1.0, XPath 1.0 and XPath 2.0, the number of built-in functions for XPath 1.0 is 50, and the number of built-in functions for XPath 2.0 is 235. So it's just a matter of implementation effort. Definitely somewhere in the future we will go up, but for any specific about that, you will have to get an answer to product management from DataPower.
Okay, so it feels like we'll stay with this the current version, well, I mean the XML specifications for quite some time.
Yes. But
okay. Gotcha. Thanks.
Okay.
The next question comes from Srini Muno. You may ask your question.
Hi, Arnon. Thanks for your presentation. Here is my doubt. Like, from an XML to a BIC64 encoding, either here my option is like we can do a BIC64 encoding either using an FFT by just defining a type as a BIC64 binary, or otherwise we can use a data power functions like a DB encode. So I don't see what the difference that is happening between these two. So which approach is the best?
It depends. With DP encode binary, you can typically only convert XML-like data. But in addition, you can use binary nodes in data core and in basic for encode. Then, if you have non-XML input data, you have no chance because you cannot execute a style sheet on non-XML data. You have to use something which converts the non-XML data to something which may be processed. One thing which I used, like a Swiss knife, is the hex binary FFD. You may use WTXMAT for doing the same. The only way you can go without using Contivo or WTX is if your input data is not direct the binary data, but you get as input soapless attachments. Because the attachments, you can extract And if you look at the attachment protocol in the documentation, you will find that you can encode binary data as from the attachment as base 64 or as hex bin.
Okay.
At this time, we have no further questions.
Thank you, Diane. At this time, we will conclude the presentation.